This is WGTD. You are listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Mike Falkowski, a former KUSD school board member, Sammy Rangel, the life technician and executive director of Life After Hate, Steve Brown, a retired professor of educational leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School superintendent, Joe Manji. Now here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD HD. I'm your host this morning, Steve Brown. And if that music sounds familiar, well, it should to a lot of us because it's the theme from the TV series Lassie that was on the air for 17 years. And my guest this morning is Robert Weatherwax. And the name Weatherwax is widely known in the dog world. Robert is a third-generation professional dog trainer and owner of the Weatherwax Dog Training System. His family has trained the original Lassie, and the original name of Lassie was actually Pal in the movie back in 1943. Also, a relative of Robert's trained Toto for The Wizard of Oz. And the theories and tactics that are used in Robert's book are applicable to any dog lover and owner, and not just those dogs that are on the big screen. And we'll be talking about his book and also how Robert continues to be involved in dog training. Robert, welcome to Education Matters here on WGTD HD.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
The title of your book, your new book, I should say, is Training Your Dog the Weatherwax Way, the complete guide to selecting, raising, and caring for your canine. And on the book cover, it's R. Rodell Weatherwax, professional dog trainer. I've read the reviews so far for the book. I'm really anxious to get my copy. Before we talk about your book, give us an overview of how you got involved and then also with this whole legacy and being involved with the whole Lassie world, if you will, has meant to you during your lifetime.
Obviously, I was raised into the film industry with, my grandfather doing Lassie, the series, at the time I was born. Matter of fact, I recollect that my father was working on the Odyssey, which was the this episode with Lassie and Timmy in the balloon.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were doing some shots out in Bell Canyon out here, not too far from where I was born in West Hills, which is West Hills Hospital, which is in what used to be called Canoga Park, but
sure.
Now it's actually called West Hills. But, I grew up in the valley, and my dad, for a number of years, worked for my grandfather. But then when the series went off in 74, he started working for another supplier out in Baldwin Park by the name of Lou Schumacher. And he was, doing jobs for him for about 3 years. And, then he went in business for himself. In 1977, we moved out of the valley into what was then Canning Country, now Santa Clarita. And he started his business, which was Weatherwax Trained Dogs, which my business is Weatherwax Dog Training.
Mm-hmm.
You can see how that could be a little confusing. But I grew up in the industry. I used to clean kennels, and, I was always involved with the dogs, whether I was at my grandfather's during the summer months at his ranch, helping him train Lassie, or during the time at home when my dad was training Lassie and or other dogs. And I was always involved in it. And then after I went to college for about a year and a half, and then I joined the Navy, and I was in the Navy for 4 years and came back, and I started working for my dad at the end of 1986. And we worked together quite a bit in the first few years, but as time went on, I started working more for independently on some of his other jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And working for some of his competitors, which a lot of the experience I get or that I display in my book is stuff not only I learned from my family, but also trainers that who I respected whose last name weren't Weatherwax.
Sure.
So there's a wide variety. I'm trying to add a little something different than what was done before.
Sure, of course. As I did my research, and you know, it was kind of a combination of my own research and just being aware over so many years of Lassie, both on TV, Tommy Reddick, John Provost, others who have been who were in the show, but also the movies. And even though this program is called Education Matters, just in case any of the listeners are wondering, why the heck is Steve, who's been doing this hosting of Education Matters for 17 years, talking about this topic, and what does this have to do with education? Educating people on how to work effectively with members of their family, and I'm talking about dogs, okay? As you know, I have border collies. I show them in the show ring, and there's a whole education that we all need to know and be aware of. So that's the hook, if you will, with regards to Education Matters and your book and everything that you've done. But, you know, one of the things that I always found interesting, that the original dog in the Lassie movie, who was named Pal, was not a female dog, but was a male dog, correct?
Yeah, he was a male dog. And all the subsequent lead dogs for Lassie were also male.
So let me ask you a question. All of the dogs who have played Lassie in the seven MGM movies, other movies that followed, the regular TV series, and there have been others, including the Magic of Lassie, which we'll talk about in a while. Why have all of the dogs that have played Lassie been male dogs, and yet Lassie is always referred to, except, of course, in the original, where the dog was Pal, as a female?
Well, the original book that was written by Eric Knight, who actually, the movie was, I believe, released posthumously.
Right.
Because he had been killed in World War II. He was an airplane pilot mm-hmm. in Britain. And he wrote the book about his dog, Toots, who was a female.
Right.
And of course, you know, when we did the movies, I think they originally had a female dog that they were filming with, but it wasn't working out so well. And the reason that Pal got the job is because he filled in as a stunt dog, stunt double for the big river crossing scene in Lassie Come Home.
Sure.
And
sure.
He did it so wonderfully that Fred Wilcox said, you know, Pal swam in, but Lassie swam out. And basically what they did is they fired the lead dog and they reshot the movie entirely with Pal. And, you know, he was a male, and, you know, they like the males because they shed less. They have tend to have a brighter coat, much like birds. You know, they're the more spectacular looking of the species. And, you know, and they were also larger. So, you know, larger dogs means more majestic, more heroic, you know.
Sure. Sure. And by the way, for our audience, Lassie Come Home, the book Eric Knight, it was actually published in 1940. The film came out, Lassie Come Home, was released in 1943. I watched it again probably a week or so ago, and I'll say it was only in preparation for this interview with you, Robert, but I loved the movie. And who was that actress who had, and because I'm setting up this question for you, who was that young actress in the movie who had a bit part, who later became a superstar, who was later in the 1946 version of a Lassie movie?
That would probably be Elizabeth Taylor.
Elizabeth right? Taylor. And when you look at the credits in the movie, her name is way, way down on the list. And, of course, that starred the great actor as a child and adult, Roddy McDowall. Give me a sense, you know, you talked about your grandfather and your dad and their involvement with, you know, what I'll just call the Lassie legacy, for lack of a better term. When you were a young boy, when you were 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, becoming a teenager, what was it like just being part of such an incredible legacy, if you will, and being connected to Lassie?
Actually, Steve, that's a good question, because I mentioned that a little bit in my book about, you know, that a somewhat celebrity status. When the series was going on, when it went off the air, I was 11 years old. So throughout elementary school and a large part of junior high school, I was looked upon as, I went by Robbie back in those days. Mm-hmm. I was Robbie. His grandfather owns Lassie Weatherwax. It's like it always went together, right?
Sure.
His grandfather owns Lassie. You know his grandfather owns Lassie? And it gave me, when I was little, I probably got a lot of little adverse attention, and bullies liked to beat me up because they thought I was some kind of special kid that needed to be shaken up a little bit.
Sure.
But later on, I think people embraced it, and, even after the series went off the air, whenever I went to the post office or showed my ID or anything, even as a teenager or young adult, I still got the, any connection to that guy who trained Lassie? And that's, and people would always mispronounce my grandfather's names because it's R-U-D-D, Rudd, and they would say, oh, your grandfather's rude, isn't he? I said, no, he's sometimes abrupt, but never rude.
Yeah. Well, I had to double check. I mean, I knew it was Rudd or Rudell, but I listened to an interview, actually, that your grandfather gave, and one of the best lines in this interview, and it's on the internet, and you can see it on Facebook, that he said one time he came home and Lassie, these are his words there, I'll paraphrase, Lassie was on the couch, and if someone wondered why Lassie could get up on the couch, Your grandfather said because he bought the couch.
That's right. So. Yeah. Rudd was very particular about people understanding that Lassie was treated just like a person.
Sure.
And people would say, he hated it when people would say when Lassie's like lying down or sometimes he didn't want anybody to pet the dog when he's on the set. They'd say, hey, Lassie's resting, and then they'd go away and say, poor dog. And then my grandfather would say, what do you mean, poor dog? This dog eats steak.
Yeah. By the way, since we're talking about your granddad, how did your granddad first actually gain possession as far as owning Lassie?
Well, the story has kind of evolved over the years, but essentially what happened was there was another trainer who had brought a dog to my grandfather who... I guess the dog was chasing motorcycles. I guess cars to some degree, but mainly motorcycles. And he had this dog for a while, and then at a certain point, the story's changed, but I was under the impression he moved and he couldn't keep the dog, so he ended up giving, in lieu of the training, which was $10 that mm-hmm. he owed Rudd, he said, just keep the dog. And my grandfather wasn't really eager to take on a collie. I think, like a lot of other trainers, he dreamed of having a strong heart or a Rin Tin Tin or somebody like a German Shepherd, a dog that was more traditional, right?
Let's talk a bit about your book. The title of your book, as I mentioned, and by the way, we will put the Amazon link and other information about your book on the WGTD website for Education Matters, but the title is Training Your Dog the Weatherwax Way, The Complete Guide to Selecting, Raising, and Caring for Your Canine. The first question that comes to mind is, how does Training Your Dog the Weatherwax Way, how does this differ from other books that might be out there about dog training?
Well, that's a very good question. The biggest... I mentioned that in the beginning of my book as well. It's like in the introduction, I talk about, what could I bring to a really crowded table? I mean, my grandfather has two training books. One, that 1951, it was the story of Lassie, and then he had the Lassie Method mm-hmm. in 71. And and my dad had a training video, and I thought, well, what am I going to, I could have written this book a long time ago, but the reason I didn't, because I kept thinking, well, what am I going to bring to the table that they haven't already brought? So what I decided was I was going to make a book that mirrored more of my private training practice and the dog, the issues that dogs have every day, not the perfect dogs you see in movies. And believe me, none of them are really perfect either. But everybody, doesn't have a Lassie. They just have Fido or whatever their dog's name is, who likes to bark at the windows and jump on people and all these things that dogs do that we don't want them to do. We want to have we want to keep them out of the shelter for one.
Sure.
And for two, we want to make it harmonious.
Right. And, you know, I mentioned before that over the years, I have had 8 border collies who have been in my family, if you will. And, and just the whole process of communicating with our dog members of the family. As you look at all of the experiences that you have had in terms of dog training, what would you say is the central theme? And you've already sort of alluded to it, but the central theme of your new book, as far as any behavioral problems that are most prevalent in dog training practices?
Well, I think the central theme is to keep it simple, because I know there's a lot of devices out there that can help you train your dog, and they all claim to be the best way there is. But I just go with the simple method that my grandfather and my father used. I'm using, basically 3 sets of tools. There's only 3 things in your toolbox, or I should probably say 4, a long leash, a short leash, a training collar, and a distraction tool.
Mm-hmm.
So that way it kind of keeps everything simple. And not only that, but humane training is a big theme, and preserving the dog's personality, because we got a dog from the shelter or as a puppy or for wherever we got this dog. And, we got him because of who he was or who she was. And we don't want to have training that changes that or modifies what we got the dog for in the first place. So I used to have a flyer early on in my private training that said, train the dog, keep the personality. And that's kind of what I'm trying to convey in the book.
Sure. And, as I read through some of the comments about your book, one of the things that I read, and I'm just reading it here, learn how to raise and train your dog using an approach customized to their needs, to their dog's needs. Why is that important that we as I'll call the owners of our pet dogs, why is it important that we know what their needs are? And then a follow-up question is obviously, how do we know what their needs are?
Well, that's a lot of what the book tells you. It tells you, route to prescribe based on different types of dogs. And I kind of categorize those dogs. And then you always want to kind of start with a softer approach to begin with. You know, you can always make your approach firmer as the canine student dictates. But I always start with a soft approach, and I try to, read the dog, and I talk about, signs that you should be looking for with your dog, signs mm-hmm. that tell you what kind of dog they are and what kind of approach should be taken. And, it is tailor-made. It's not we're not baking cookies. They're not supposed to be all the same shape and the same brownness. They're all different, and if you use the correct approach according to the type of dog you have, then you're going to expedite the training process, because you won't be taking any steps backwards because you took the initial approach incorrectly and had to retrace your steps. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's a great lead-in to the question: how does the average person who has a pet dog, and you mentioned about reading your dog, how do you do that?
Well, you're seeing signs, like you're seeing the way they. They look at you, the way they look at other people, the way they look at objects, cars, cats. So you want to expose them to as many things as possible early on, so that you can target exactly what problems need to be fixed. Because if you never take your dog out to experience the world, how are you going to know what triggers exist in the world for your dog?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the triggers are going to be different for each dog. So it's good to recognize those things early when the dog is still in his formative years, so that it's easier to eradicate it should they exist.
Sure. And, another thing in reading at least what's online, and I obviously have not read your entire book, and I look forward to getting it the first part of November, and we'll talk more about how people can actually order it in a few minutes. But in terms of how do we send the right message to our dog? How do we do that even when we're not using any verbal commands?
Well, a lot of it is body language. You know, I mentioned that, you know, dog getting a little bit of distance from your dog, even on a walk, sometimes can be good when a dog is upset or something. That sometimes I think the attitude you have to have when your dog is upset is not one where you're comforting them or you're doing anything to validate their fear. You're kind of dismissing it, but you're rewarding them in the situations that upset them. So, but you're not using a lot of voice and a lot of touch because you don't want to send the wrong message. You don't want to send the inadvertent messages to your dog that you approve of bad behavior. And that can happen simply by trying to calm your dog while he's barking ferociously at a dog across the street.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the best thing to do is let the dog get away from you a little bit and kind of negotiate things without your assistance, without your body being right next to them, and let them kind of marinate in that feeling, and then call them back to you, give them a reward. So you're basically, you know, saying that I don't care if you want to bark at this dog or you want to look at this dog. I'm just going to keep bringing you back, feeding you, and pretty soon you're not going to care about that dog. I mean, there's a lot of things that's a very broad question. There's a lot of, like, particular situations I could give you, but sometimes it's the messages we send to our dog that we don't even know we're sending.
Okay, give me an example of that.
Okay, a woman's walking down the street and she's got a little dog, and her dog starts barking at somebody. And instead of just staying there and maybe using their leg to kind of tap them and say, hey, that's enough, something
mm-hmm.
gentle, but something that gets their attention. That's the distraction that we're looking for. And then what will that woman do? She'll comfort her dog and then maybe even pick them up and take them home. Well, what she's taught her dog is that whenever a situation gets rough, she's just going to praise them and take them away from the situation. So they'll never actually learn to deal with it. They'll only learn to be saved from it.
By the way, if any of our listeners have just tuned in, this is, of course, Education Matters on WGTD, and I am talking to Robert Weatherwax, whose brand new book that will come out in November, Training Your Dog the Weatherwax Way. And, of course, the name Weatherwax is widely known in the dog world, and he's the author. And Robert is a third-generation professional dog trainer and owner of the Weatherwax Dog Training. And, of course, the family trained the original Lassie. And by the way, since we have talked a lot about your book, give our listeners very specific information on how they can pre-order your book, which will be delivered sometime in early November.
Absolutely. Well, I've obviously, you know, to differentiate myself from my family, I've, you know, used this SAG name, R. Riddell Weatherwax. So if you Google either my name, R.RUDDELL, Weatherwax, or just simply the Weatherwax Way,
mm-hmm.
you'll probably get a number of hits that you can choose from. There's everything from Walmart to Barnes & Noble. Right now, Amazon is offering the book for $19.99, which is cheaper than you can get it anywhere else. It's about $7 cheaper than most of the other outlets. I know it's also being offered overseas on different websites, you know, Japan and Germany and Finland.
Sure.
And so it's out there. You know, the reason I'm so adamant about people pre-ordering is because I know that, you know, the number of pre-orders will dictate the number of actual copies in the bookstores come November 2nd when it hits bookstores.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I just wanted it to have a strong presence. I mean, not that there won't be a second run, but the first run is pretty important, you know, getting that momentum coming out of the gate.
Sure, of course.
Sure.
And as we all know, everything comes down to marketing and making people aware. And by the way, we do have listeners who listen to WGTD Public Radio, which is affiliated with Wisconsin Public Radio and also National Public Radio, actually all over the world because we're on the internet as well as your phone app, WGTD.org, or WGTD-FM for either your iPhone or your Android. By the way, when I told a friend of mine that I was going to be interviewing you today, she wanted me to ask you, and I'll leave the answer totally up to you, and I did not mention this ahead of time to you because I wanted to get your response, that she said, ask Mr. Weatherwax what he thinks of how about Cesar Millan, who of course has been doing his show has been on for years and years on television, but just his approach, and you know, if you want to be specific, that's fine. I'll leave that up to you.
Yeah, I get that question a lot. I kind of consider myself just a little bit of an anti-Cesar. I know that there's a lot of people that like Cesar, and I know his methods probably work for a lot of dogs, but I don't see the kind of versatility from somebody like Cesar Millan. I think that you know, he works well with tough dogs, aggressive dogs, it seems to me, because he tends to be a little heavy-handed himself.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there, you know, he's not as flexible, and he's not going to be working dogs that, you know, pee all over themselves the second you reach down to pet them.
Sure.
I'm more of a motivational trainer, so I'm very good at building timid dogs, fear aggressive dogs, dogs that aren't sure of themselves. What I do is I give the dog the courage to go along with their personality, and I don't believe that Cesar does that.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's a straightforward answer, I'll make sure that my friend, I'll ask her, I'll make sure she listens to the program to hear your answer rather than me telling her. As I look at more of the comments about your book, Training Your Dog the Weatherwax Way, one of the things that's noted is that you talk about implementing techniques that will allow a person's dog to interact well in situations. Maybe if you can elaborate on that and how you talk about that in your book.
Yeah, well, a big part of it is the leash and the training collar. And I believe that when you put a leash and a collar, other than the collar they wear all the time, when you put that on your dog, it's sending a message that something different is happening here.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of dogs think that the only thing different is that we're going for a walk, but we don't want the leash and the collar to just mean we're going for a walk. So we want to get them used to when they're working to have a leash and collar on, and when they're not working to release that leash and collar so that we very clearly delineate when it's play and when it's work. It doesn't mean that work has to be unfun. It doesn't have to be a drag, but it's different. It's just a different. It just says that you're saying to your dog, this leash and collar is going on. Good behavior will now be expected, and then you're in a position to enforce it without touching the dog. You know, chasing him around the house or grabbing him by the neck. You have a tool you can use to correct that dog humanely and calmly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you
that's
know
one of the techniques. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, when I show my current border collie Sadie, who's a champion now, and she's going for her, and she's earning points now towards her grand championship, when I put her lead on that is only for the show ring, and I only put that on her when we are getting ready to go to a show. And so she knows, although she knows ahead of time anyway, because she's being groomed and everything. But yeah, I mean, that's obviously, they pick up on things very quickly, don't they?
Yeah, you mentioned too, I mean, your dog is learning from the pattern, you know, your pattern of when you do certain things. Like, why is my dad brushing me now? Normally when he brushes me, we're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, normally when my owner gets nervous, that means there's a dog around the corner. So, I mean, you're sending signals to your dog. You're sending positive signals to your dog. But a lot of people send negative signals for their dog because they're afraid of something and it actually makes their dog afraid of it.
Sure. And doesn't that also go back directly to just how intelligent most dogs are and they pick up on those things very quickly?
Exactly. That's why that, you know, when you have a dog that's nervous, it's good to get them to where they're not so clingy. You know, you want to try to build distance. It doesn't mean you push them away from you. It just means that every time they get near you, you step away.
Sure.
So you're basically saying to them, I won't help you in this situation, but I'm here.
Sure.
And that's it. Yeah.
Robert, one of the movies Lassie was in the late 1970s called The Magic of Lassie. And one of the songs in that movie was sung by Debbie Boone. And I know that it's one of your favorites. And let's listen to just a bit of that.
When you're out there on your own, trying to make it all alone, 'cause you seek the missing pieces of your life. It's a rough and tumble journey on a road that never ends. It's a cold, cold world you're walking through, my friend. But when you're loved, when you're...
Why is that one of your favorites? And I know Greensleeves was another, but why does that one stand out for you from the movie The Magic of Lassie that was released back in 1978? And by the way, it starred, if our listeners are not familiar, it starred Jimmy Stewart in his final appearance in a live action film. It also starred Mickey Rooney, Pernell Alice Roberts. Faye, and Pernell Roberts, of course, from Bonanza, and Stephanie Zimbalist. But why does that song stand out for you?
It's kind of a touching song, and I think that when I hear it, it kind of brings back warm memories of my grandfather. So I think that it's, you know, it's one of those songs that you have to be in the right mood to listen to it. But when I want to be retrospective and think about wonderful times that I miss, that's the song I play.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd like to throw those fading dreams away, 'cause the road keeps leading nowhere. Empty days and endless nights, that happy journey.
And how many times have you watched the movie The Magic Lassie out of curiosity?
I still own that on videotape. When it first came out, I watched it many, many times, and I still listen to the end credits on YouTube quite a bit.
Sure.
It's got that song, and just the whole ending of the movie.
Sure.
Is pure Lassie magic, you know.
Sure.
And that's but I don't think the movie was well received back then because, you know, it was kind of the age of, Star Wars was getting mm-hmm. ready to come out. And it just wasn't, it was a little too old-fashioned for where the general viewing audience was moving.
Mm-hmm. And were you involved in some way in the movie?
Well, I used to go up to Solvang where they were shooting a lot of that up there. And I used to hang out in my grandfather's trailer. And, there was... just hanging out with my grandfather and my dad and Sam and Sam Williamson, who was my grandfather's first assistant for most of the time the Lassie series was on. It was always fun being with them. And, I remember Slip T. Anderson's soup up there and just all how green it was. And, we shot a lot of that right up there in that area, in the Napa Valley area.
Sure. So tell me, what kinds of other things are you involved with? How does Robert Weatherwax stay busy on a day-to-day basis that our audience would be interested in knowing?
Well, I mean, currently I'm still finishing my training schedule here in Los Angeles before I shut things down and move, get started getting ready to move in earnest to Texas. So training is a lot of what I'm doing. I'm, you know, also, you know, working on other books, though I'll probably be working on that more intensely once I get done promoting this book. But I do have a few other books that I've started, and but right now I'm staying pretty busy just training dogs and moving.
Sure. One of the things I always like to ask as we get towards the end of an interview, and that is, are there any questions whatsoever that I have not asked about anything that you would want to talk about that you'd want to share with our audience?
Maybe I'll give you the story that nobody else ever asked me about.
Okay.
The story, you know, there's another trainer who I just went to a Dodger game with him last night. He's taking over my dog training here in L.A. when I moved to Texas. He's another movie trainer.
Mm-hmm.
His name's William S. Grisco, and his father and my father used to be partners years ago with Weatherwax Trained Dogs back in 1976. So I've known William since we were both teenagers, both of us the sons of accomplished movie trainers. And we were working on a job video called In the Closet with Michael Jackson. And we were doing it out in the Salton Sea, and we had oxen. Billy Rivers brought some oxen, and we had some goats, and we had some dogs. And they were just doing background while Michael did the video. We're doing this video, and after we shot most of the primary video, the AD, the assistant director, runs up to us with a walkie-talkie, and he says, because we had a baby goat that was actually born on the set while we were filming, right? Or a couple of baby goats, I should say. So Michael had asked the AD, Mr. Jackson wants to see you in his dressing room. And he said, bring the baby goat, right? So we brought the baby goat, William and I, and we were sitting there in front of Michael, and we handed the goat to him. And it seemed like 5 minutes that he was just looking down at that goat, just stroking him and looking into his eyes and his face, I should say. He was like, oh, he's so pure. Don't you wish people were this pure? And he was just in love with this goat, and he asked us some questions about the goat, and we were just sitting right across the table from him. And then, after what seemed like an eternity, he gave us back the goat, and then he asked us if we had any other animals. And William said, oh, yeah, we have some dogs. And he goes, oh, I don't like dogs. They bite. So I know that Michael didn't like dogs, but he did like chimps, and he did like baby goats.
Okay.
So that much I know.
Yeah, and in fact, I'm just looking at some of the credits for Mr. Grisco and the movie back in 2005, a Lassie movie that starred Peter O'Toole.
Yeah, he did that for Gary Giroux. I believe they got their collies up in Great Britain. They did some filming in Scotland and Ireland. And, but that was after we were no longer involved with Lassie. And keep in mind that, my father thought a lot of William as well, and I figure he probably would have been somewhat happy that even though another company was doing Lassie, that William was involved in it. But
sure.
It was, they got all the dogs over there, and they had to train them there because, you know, they have a quarantine law.
Mm-hmm.
And British Isles. So.
The last question I want to ask you, Robert, in terms of collies, and of course Lassie and all the dogs who have played Lassie in all the movies have been rough collies. Give me just your overall view and assessment of why someone who might be looking for a dog to join their family, and they're looking at a litter of puppies. Why a collie is a breed that they should seriously consider?
Well, obviously, I mentioned other dogs as well in the book as being good choices for as family dogs, but Collie is one of them. And the reason being is that they're gentle. I very seldom run into any really aggressive Collies, though they do tend to be somewhat timid from time to time. They don't typically lash out in the midst of their fear at anybody they love. And I just find them to be a very stable breed, but a breed that needs to be trained with a soft hand. They're not, if you have a heavy hand, you're used to training German Shepherds, you're going to have to be re-educated when you train a Collie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. You're going to learn that less is more,
sure,
a Collie.
Sure. Yeah. I think in an interview you did, it was a podcast back a few years ago, you mentioned that when you're looking for a dog in a litter, you mentioned something along the lines that it should be one of those little puppies that sort of stands back and is watching and is not one that comes right up to you.
Yeah, exactly. Because I feel like they feel like, oh, the dog's jumping all over the fence. He must love me. But he's also going to be a handful to train. And some people are okay with that. Other people are like, I want to push the easy button. Well, that dog is definitely not the easy button. And the dog that's hiding in the corner, that's not the easy button either because he's probably timid.
Right.
So, you want to find the happy medium. Like in my book, I mentioned you want to start at the middle of the teeter-totter.
Mm-hmm.
You can tip it either way later on, but keep it level in the beginning.
Yeah. And again, the book, and if you, for our listening audience, if you do a Google search and you type in R. Rudell, R-U-D-D-E-L-L, Weatherwax, Training Your Dog the Weatherwax Way, the book will come up, and as Robert said, it's available on a number of sites. I got mine through Amazon, by the way. And Robert, I want to thank you so much for taking your time. I know you're busy doing all kinds of things, including getting ready to move to Texas. And, of course, you went to a Dodger game last night, and I'm a Brewers fan, and the Brewers are in first place. So maybe the Brewers and Dodgers will be in the National League Championship again.
Sounds like a plan to me.
Anyway, Robert, thank you so much for being with us this morning and here on Education Matters.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure. It has been a pleasure.
And I would like to thank Robert Weatherwax for taking his time this morning in joining us here on Education Matters. I'm your host, Steve Brown, hoping that you have a great rest of the day and a wonderful weekend. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org. You're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. Support for WGTD comes from the law offices of Frank J. Parise, helping serve criminal defense needs, including traffic and DUIs, for over 35 years. Call 262-656-9906 for more info. From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, UW Parkside presents the 27th Parkside National Print Exhibition, showcasing original prints, now through October 2nd, with an award reception September 23rd from 4 to 6. Visit uwp.edu/PNPE.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist with the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring, a former marketing manager at Gateway Technical College.